going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
Thanks so much, Capital is the Going Deep podcast, and I am Donovan Bennett, and I'm back in our Toronto studios, back from Las Vegas. Happy to be back, happy to have this episode for you, because it is with two people that I admire and aspire to be like, two people who are much faster than me, even though I think I'm fast, at least I once was fast. Now I am more of the tortoise than the hare, if you will, but we'll get to them in a bit. Back from Las Vegas, because I was there covering the NHL draft, which was epic. It was in the Sphere, which if you haven't been there, it's outstanding. I'll tell you what I was doing there at the end of the episode, so listen through to get that content. But I just want to shout out the NHL for doing a great job hosting, the entire city of Vegas, which hosted the Copa America, a UFC fight, and the NHL draft in the same weekend. Obviously, when you're in Vegas, I was there for work, but you have some fun as well. And I want to shout out Topgolf, who graciously hosted me as I had some fun in between working at their Las Vegas location, which is their flagship and, for my estimation, their best. I've been to the one in Scottsdale as well. But if you can imagine the strip just behind the MGM Grand Hotel and Casino, the 8 acres of land, the 105,000 square feet, three stories, if you will, that's Topgolf. And my golf game needs some work, but I certainly had some fun. You can check out the fun I had on my social, on my stories. Go into the bio of this pod or just give me a follow at Donovan Bennett on IG and on Twitter. Two guys who have built a massive following. Andre DeGrasse and Andrew Harris. A and A, both of them being A1. We'll start with Andre DeGrasse because they're in different parts of their story, their journey in their career. And I talked to Andre last year about the book that he wrote, but the chapter is not done. By the way, it was both a great conversation and a great book. So scroll down in the feed and listen to it after you listen to this one and go out and buy his book. But he's trying to write a fairy tale ending to that story. He's already a 6-time Olympic medalist, but he's going into these games maybe an outsider in terms of the betting favorites, maybe an underdog, considering that Noah Lyles has had a great track season. But I never count out Andre. And maybe people mistake the fact that he's not as demonstrative as other sprinters with the fact that he doesn't care as much or he isn't as focused, but it's just that West Indian in him that he's just happy-go-lucky, happy to show up and compete. And when you see him, good race, bad race, healthy, injured, he's always smiling. So I want to talk to him about that mindset and the potential that this could be his last opportunity to add more Olympic medals to that haul, specifically the medal that eludes him, that gold in the 100 specifically, but also this guy's got a 1,000 watt smile. We've seen it on the podium. We've seen it when he and Usain Bolt have been going back and forth during races. We see him in the interviews as well. And actually, I should say that although his smile is much nicer than mine, we do go to the same dentist. So shout out to Dr. Williams. At least we did. Andre is not in Canada as much, but no matter where he is, he's got a great and healthy smile because like me, he used Invisalign aligners. So interested to know from him if he's going to be packing those aligners with him, expecting lots of Getty images taken of him with medals around his neck. Could it be the last games for Andre the Great? And what's it like for him to taper towards the Paris Olympics, knowing that all people care about for him is the color of the medal, nothing else. We're going to talk to Andre. We're going to talk to Andrew Harris in a bit, but first, Andre DeGrasse, smiling for gold.
Andre, good to see you again. So happy that you're once again, as always, smiling and excited to represent the country. Talk to me about this partnership with Invisalign, because as you know, we've gone to the same dentist from time, and I got my Invisalign from the person who took care of you. But, you know, for someone who loves life and always smiling, why did this partnership make sense?
Yeah, I mean, you said it. Same dentist. I remember, you know, back in 2017, I went to go see my dentist, and, you know, we're just chatting, hanging out. And he was like, hey, you know, you ever tried Invisalign clear aligners? And I was like, no. He's like, yeah, I recommend that you try this. You know, you're always on TV. I see you always smiling, and I want to make sure, like, you know, I'm your dentist. I want to make sure that you have the perfect smile and you're just, you know, doing your thing. So I was like, yeah. So he did the procedure. It was quick and fast. You know, I used it, you know, every night, went to bed with it in my mouth. So it was just something that was just, it was just easy to do. And, yeah, I had the procedure. It was all good. It kind of gave me that confidence that I needed. I had confidence already, but just more confidence, more swagger. So, you know, it was just easy to kind of just go out there and just smile for the camera and kind of do my thing. So yeah, this partnership was authentic. It was real. And yeah, it was just a no brainer for me to, you know, kind of get that done.
Shout out to Dr. Williams, who hit me up in 2016 before my wedding. So I wasn't getting ready for the Olympics. My big day was a little bit different than yours. How were you as a patient? Did you were you diligent? Were on time with the trays, or were there some cheat days in there? What was the progress like?
No, definitely. I mean, it was definitely some cheat days where sometimes you kind of forget to, you know, kind of do all the necessary things you need to do, and, you know, go to bed with it and kind of wear it throughout the day. And I remember, you know, going back, you know, you get your checkup and you're like, hey, are you wearing it every day? And I was like, I'm going to do it. And eventually I was like, yeah, I started, you know, just being more focused and more diligent. And I just kind of saw the results so quickly. And I was like, why am I playing around right now? Why am I doing this to myself? You know? So it's definitely something that's kind of just helped me along the way. And, you know, I'm pretty proud that I actually got that. And like you said, and, you know, other people always say, you know, you got a great smile, and, you know, that's all because of those Invisalign clear aligners.
So our mutual friend, Cabby, got them around the same time, and he was not diligent. It took him like 2 years where I was the opposite. I was like, I need to get this process over with. So I'm going to be in here in this chair every 2 weeks for the next set of trays. But that's right. But I did not have the focus and diligence that you have as an athlete, which is why I'm on this side of the Zoom. Talk to me about your training, tapering every year for, you know, Worlds and whatnot, the end of the Diamond League. But really and truly, when you're at your level, the years that matter are the Olympic years. And now we're close. How do you feel, you know, now that we're really a month away?
Yeah, it's coming fast for real. But yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. I'm excited. You know, it's crazy to say that it's going to be, you know, my third Olympic Games. I mean, time has gone by so fast since I was a young kid, you know, getting ready for Rio. And yeah, I'm just pretty, really pumped up. I mean, you know, I got my Olympic trials next week in Montreal to qualify. I just ran my season's best, my fastest time in a couple years. So in 100 meters, I had a race the other day in Finland. So I'm feeling, you know, pretty good. I'm feeling like my old self, and you know, I'm ready to kind of, you know, represent the country and kind of do this all over again and try to bring back some medals. So it's definitely, I kind of want that deja vu feeling, if you know what I mean.
No doubt. It's funny because for you, with your season's best, people are like, well, what about the personal best? You've set such a high standard. I wonder if you give yourself some grace in terms of how you're feeling physically, mentally, and how the stopwatch is feeling.
I mean, I know for people that don't know track, I mean, yeah, it's like, you know, if they think that you might think that, you know, you got to run your personal best every single time, but it doesn't work like that. I mean, you try to build and, you know, get better, you know, every day, so that when you get to the games or even get to a big competition, that's when you like run your fastest that you ever run, you know, and that's what you call a peak. So yeah, I mean, for me, I'm in a good spot. I feel like I'm in a good spot to run this fast, you know, 5 weeks away from the games. I feel like I'm in a good spot to say, okay, when I get to the games, I'm definitely going to be able to run a personal best and run my best I've ever ran. Just going off of statistics and, you know, what I've done in the past and, you know, just saying, oh, wow, like I ran 10 flat the other day and I probably haven't done that, you know, at this time of the year, you know, getting ready for my last Olympic game. So that kind of really kind of just gives me that confidence in myself. And it says, okay, yeah, I'm physically prepared. You know, I'm feeling good. Now it's all about the mental now, because when I get there, I just got to, you know, let my mind, you know, take it at ease, let the pressure handle itself, stay calm, enjoy the moment, and just go out there and, you know, be yourself.
It's funny. I was having this, you know, debate argument with some other people and they were worried, oh my goodness, is he going to qualify? And I was like, don't watch that. He's not, you know, new to this. He's true to this. Like, he's West Indian. We show up when we want to on time. And for you, how much confidence can you take in your previous experience, knowing that, you know, no matter what the form has been coming into a meet, you can, in the same way you do executing your race plan, kind of stay relaxed and not, you know, panic essentially?
Yeah, I mean, I just rely on my experience. Just knowing that I've been here before, I've done it plenty of times. You know, I've done the repetitions in practice. I put in the work. I made the sacrifices. So I just know that, you know, when I get there and I get to the games, you know, you just go out there and enjoy the moment, have fun. The work has been done. Now you trusted the process, and now you just got to go out there and, you know, like I said, be yourself and bring your best, bring your A game. And I think, you know, when I get to a championship, you know, that extra adrenaline, and just knowing that, just knowing what's on the line and what you want to accomplish, I don't know, it kind of just brings the best out of me. It just, you know, it's like a game seven. You know, I've never been in a game seven situation, and, you know, basketball's, you know, one of my other favorite sports. I've never been in a game seven, but when I'm just watching it on TV and just watching my favorite players and just seeing how they operate, I kind of really just bring that same mindset when I get to the Olympic Games and saying, you know, going through the rounds, you know, go through the semis, and now, you know, get to the finals. It's just like, you leave it all out there and whatever happens, happens. But, you know, just knowing that, hey, I left it all out there on the line. I gave it my best shot. I put in the work, the last 6-7 months of training. I did all the right things necessary. I followed the plan. And then you just go out there and let loose. So that's how I always approach it. And just now saying that, hey, I still have nerves, but, you know, it's good nerves. It's like, yeah, I've been here before, and I just kind of rely on that experience.
In track for you, it's like you're in multiple series at the same time, where game one and game seven are at different time. You've got the 100, you've got the 200, and then there's obviously the 4x1. How do you plan to manage the energy, the anxiety around those three events, knowing that, you know, there's some real competitors who are only focused on one?
Yeah, I think for me, my coach and my team kind of just prepare me for that. Yeah, having them in my corner, the stuff that we do in training, my coach always says, like, this is going to prepare you for the rounds. You know, you got to do this work. Because I remember there's some workouts where I'm like, coach, I'm not trying to do that today. Like, this, that's a lot. Oh, you're going to kill me like this? He's like, Dre, you got to do this. You know, this is the stuff that's gonna make you a champ. Like, you gotta finish that last rep. You know, you finish that last rep. So when you get to the games, the first round, second round, it's gonna be a cakewalk. It's gonna be so easy. So I kind of always remember that. So I think, you know, just the pump up speeches, the mental side of it, just telling yourself that you can do it. And it is possible, you know, and having that faith in yourself and just being, yeah, having that confidence and everything, that kind of just takes me to that next level. And I think it's like when you get there, it's different, right? You ride the wave, you ride the adrenaline from the fans. You're not thinking about how tired you are. You're just, you know, you're laser focused. I mean, it's crazy to say this. Like, I remember, even after I won my 200 meter title in Tokyo, I wasn't tired. Like, I was just like, yeah, I'm ready to go. Like, 4x100 meter relays the next day, I got like 3-4 hours of sleep. I didn't even feel like I even slept that night. I felt like I got no REM, and it was just like, I was just wired, and I was just like, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to do it again. So it's kind of like, you're not even thinking about how tired you are in that moment. You're just like, yeah, I got to do it. Got to make it happen. But I think, yeah, it's like when that adrenaline stops and everything kind of like everything's over, it's like that's when you kind of crash. You're like, oh, thank God it's done. Like, it's over, you know, and you kind of just crash those next 2 days. Like, I remember, like, yeah, because for Rio and Tokyo, I was there an extra 2 days after I was done. And like, I literally almost missed the closing ceremony because like after it was over, like I was just crashed out. I was done. And like, my teammates had to wake me up. It's like, oh, it's time. We got to go to the closing ceremony. We got like an hour. Get ready. And I was so tired. I was like, I don't want to go. I'm tired. He's like, no, we got to go. We got to finish the games. So I think it's really just, like I said, it's the adrenaline that just kind of keeps you going and gets you through those rounds.
Well, lastly, the reason why you probably felt like you didn't sleep is because you were away from your children, Andre, and you could get some good sleep. Now the world is different in comparison to the last games, where the world's opened up, the family can come with, if you so choose. You don't have to be talking to them virtually on a screen the way we are right now. I want to know, you know, what that looks like for you in not retiring you yet, but what could be your last games. What's the plan for the crew, for the family, for the mandem? How many people are you bringing with you? Which it's a business trip, but it's also, yeah, you know, it's special.
No, definitely the family is coming, the kids and, you know, mom. And yeah, I got at least a minimum, probably like 5-6 people coming, but I don't know who else wants to come. I mean, of course, yeah, there's always friends and cousins and everybody else. And you're like, all right, well, you know, don't leave it to last minute. I mean, let me know if you want to come. I mean, so I can plan out tickets, you know, things get sold out fast. But if you guys got your accommodation sorted out, make you guys got your Airbnb or, you know, your hotel, whatever you guys are going to get, yeah, just let me know. But yeah, definitely the crew will be coming. My kids, they come to like every, yeah, they didn't get to come to Tokyo, but they came to the last couple of world championship in Oregon and Budapest. So yeah, they'll definitely be coming. My mom always comes, supports me. She's been there since my first games, my first Olympic games in Rio. So yeah, I mean, it's yeah, the crew's coming, definitely. I mean, but yeah, we'll see how many people are on board, you know. But I just tell people, I'm like, hey, make sure it's not last minute because I can't help you.
Well, the other thing you got to make sure is when you go, you pack those liners with you, that last tray that you have, because I'm expecting those tight slow-mo shots of the relaxed face where we see the teeth, those photos we'll see forever of you on the podium. So you got to make sure that you don't lose all that good work. Bring the trays with you and go have yourself a meet, man. So proud of you and so excited for you this summer.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Donovan. Thank you, man. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks so much to Andre, and good to know that he is as focused on his dental journey as his Olympic journey, and he's got his Invisalign liners packed and ready to go after a nice end to the season. Went out and punched his ticket to the Paris Olympics at the Bell Trials in Montreal. We will see him in Paris representing Canada in the one, the two, and the four by one. So Andre's trying to finish his career strong. Someone who did that running of a different sort is Andrew Harris, as he is now retired from the CFL, but still having a huge impact on aspiring Canadian football players, especially running backs. After the break, we go deep with Andrew Harris.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson is a show.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that you had the show. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. It is the Going Deep podcast, and we'll go deep with a running back next. And talked to Andre DeGrasse earlier, and his career is worthy of a documentary, and so maybe we'll see that after these games. And Andrew Harris wasted no time after his career was over to get busy and give us the documentary of his life and his football story. It's called Running Back Relentless. Shout out to Taylor Prestige and Justin Dunk as the producers, alongside with him, is brought to us by Upper Canada Films. And Harris is real interesting. I mean, I knew his story, and I knew the fact that he went straight from junior football to the CFL and essentially had the type of career as a Canadian running back that no one outside of John Cornish really has ever had. But I didn't realize everything he had to go through to get to that point, and everything he still carries with him now based off of his life experiences, his upbringing. And that's why this movie is not so much a Wikipedia story on his football accomplishments. It is a human interest story on the man that Andrew Harris has become and continues to strive to be. I mean, you don't need to hear me tell it. Let's talk to Andrew Harris about the feature documentary from Upper Canada Films, Running Back Relentless, his story, which is out now. Let's go deep with Andrew Harris.
I honestly feel like I have no limit. I push limits on the field. I push limits partying-wise. I push limits training-wise. I push limits socially. I push limits emotionally. My biggest fear is to lose or to fail at anything that I do in life.
It's just unbelievable. He came from the Canadian Junior Football League, which most people probably have never heard of, and has one of the best CFL careers in the history of Canadian football. It's unheard of.
The CFL's leading rusher for the past 3 years, Andrew Harris.
Andrew did it his own way. Anybody who played with him knows that that is the case.
Andrew Harris wants to prove a lot of people wrong in the criticism he's faced.
I would never intentionally cheat. I'm in a situation right now where I'm being questioned. My hole that I was in was the darkest, deepest, disgustingest place you want to go to. That's where I wanted to be. I'm kind of an insatiable person. I always want more, and nothing really satisfies me. The next chapter of my life is one I'm ready for, but it's also terrifying. Terrified about failing.
Well, first and foremost, congrats. I feel like you've accomplished so much already that there's lots to celebrate. But when you bring a documentary in the world, it's almost like you're welcoming, you know, this new child to the world for everyone to kind of see and love on. What has it been like for you to see the response, never mind going through the process?
Yeah, I think we go through the process of, you know, one, deciding you're going to do this. It's a tough thing to kind of like agree to first, right? And then you go through the process of how are we going to tell this story? What's the end goal? And you kind of just go through all these ideas and of how it's going to be pushed out. And I finally just kind of said, like, if we're going to do this, I'm going to go all in and I'm going to share, you know, my trauma, you know, the dark parts that really affected me more than anything, you know, throughout my career.
And then you know, we do all the footage and the B-roll, and then you sit back and you watch it, and it's like, wow, okay, how are we gonna cut this now? How are we going to, you know, tell this story? So the first couple edits, you know, I was critiquing it, and I was like, you know what, we gotta put it this way, we gotta put it that way, and you know, and even up until we did the Winnipeg screening, and you know, we had so much footage, and there's so much that was left out from the film. Might be a book in the future, but yeah, just putting it all together and watching it, and always critiquing it, and always trying to like, okay, how can we make this better? How can we change this? And how can we add? And just tell the story as best as possible. I didn't really accept it for what it was, and as it just being a thing until the Toronto viewing last Friday, and I was just like, wow, this is just it. It is what it is, you know. It is my story, and it is raw, and it's honest, and it's vulnerable, and this is gonna help someone, you know. And even, you know, after watching it in front of my peers, family, and you know, 400 people in Winnipeg, and then another 250 in Toronto, having multiple people that aren't even really sports fans, football fans, come up to me and say I can relate to that, and that impacted me, is exactly the whole point of it. You know, I think it's relatable to a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. And I think it is a sports, it's a documentary about a football player, but it's not a football documentary. It's very raw and honest, and you know, true telling of, you know, and in the public eye, you know, everything is just amazing, and you know, I'm achieving goals and I'm doing so well, but underneath the mask and underneath, deep down inside, you know, there was a lot of pain and trauma and darkness that, you know, helped feed what I was doing on the field, but as a whole, I wasn't okay, and it led to scary moments in my life where, you know, I didn't think I was gonna wake up the next day, you know, and being able to kind of go through those things, express them, was tough, and even too, watching it, I still get uncomfortable. You know, people knowing that people are gonna be seeing it and watching it, I get uncomfortable. But again, I think it's bigger than me. It's bigger than football. It's bigger than all the Grey Cups. I think it's bigger than my whole career. I think this piece here is going to really help someone, and that's the goal for me.
How'd you come to the decision to do it? Because it could have been very easy for you to ride off into the sunset, and the legacy is 4-time champ, greatest Canadian running back ever, arguably greatest running back ever. End of the story.
Yeah.
Why did you say, well, actually, no, I want to divulge more of the story than people would have known?
Yeah, I think that side of it is, there's a lot of different ways to kind of, you know, go and reasons why. But initially, you know, Taylor Prestige, the producer, we had built up a relationship through back when we had Team Shaw, the Team Shaw stuff, and with the CFL when I was in BC. So we did some videos and some like light content back then. We became close. And then in 2018, we did a short little film that was went around through TSN called I Shouldn't Be Here. And I was just kind of scratching the surface on, like, you know, me talking about my relationship with my mother, you know, my father, you know, and then a lot happened from 2018 on till now. And he approached me and said, hey, like, you know, we can have full access to you for, you know, like a year and a half, basically, your last season. You know, we can dive back into, you know, all these things that you've kind of been through at childhood, and get more in depth into it. We can also, you know, just share your stories of, you know, the highs, the lows, and then also just follow you for a full season and see what it's like day in the life. You know, the injury happens and all these different things kind of happen while they're shooting and following me. So once he kind of put it to me that way, and you know, I was like, you know, this again, and this was probably like 2023 when I decided to do this. I just realized how much I'd been through and how much I achieved. And I think the biggest part for me was again, just realizing I never would have thought I would have been in this situation, you know, coming out of junior football. And I got here, you know, with a lot of pain and trauma and adversity. And I think that's pretty powerful. And I've said this before, you know, I'm more proud of what I achieved and accomplished off the field, you know, just personally, than what anything you could ever give me on the field. Because I mean, there's so many different ways this could have went, you know. You know, I'm writing a recommendation letter for a friend that's getting out of prison, you know, next month, you know, and that was my reality, you know, and I'm writing a letter to, you know, tell the jail that, you know, or the court that he should be out, you know, and he's got a young son too, and you know, these were the people that I was associated with, and this was the route that I was going, and it could have went so many different ways if I didn't have this great game of football. And the great relationships that I built and got throughout it.
Certainly as football players, as men, definitely as black men, we don't talk about trauma and we certainly don't seek out help.
Yeah.
You did both and now you're exposing both. How did you get to that place that many of us don't?
Yeah, man, it's just... I just realized what life could have been for me, or lack of life could have been with me for me if I didn't. Throughout going through these things, I pushed everyone away from me. Like I was fighting this as hard as I could just to like tough it out, and you know, for lack of better words, not be a pussy. You know, I'm not gonna be a little bitch about this. I'm just gonna thug it out, and you know, like I always had, but. You know, when you bury so much for so long and you just keep burying and burying and burying and burying, and you finally hit just this breaking point of like, you know, you just can't deal with it anymore. That's where I was at, and the reaction that the chain reaction that it was taking me down in this negative lane was dangerous. And it was hurting myself. I was hurting other people around me. And again, like I didn't, there was no like tomorrow for me, you know? So, you know, I had a chosen couple few friends that I, you know, that I kind of related this to, and they were there for me, you know, seeking out, you know, a sports psychologist. And honestly, like I just cried, man. Like, you know, I just cried to her and she just listened, and you know, she barely, I honestly don't even remember her really saying too much to me, but it was just a person that was non-biased. I could just tell my truths to and just let it out. And man, like what a relief it was. Like, and even still, like I have gone through this, and it's been very therapeutic for me. And I'm a much more accepted myself in my own skin, and relatable to other people that, you know, I can kind of see their pain more. I can see their troubles, and I can be able to kind of be like, hey man, it's okay. You know, just like, give me a hug, bro. Like, you know, like it's just, there's little things that we just go along that we just try to bury all the time. But when I see my friends in these situations now, I think they're more forthcoming to like, want to talk about things. And I think as athletes, especially, we wear this mask and we try to be so tough all the time. And you know, you go through injury, you go through getting cut, traded, you know, relationship stuff behind the scenes, you know, like whatever it was, baby mama drama, you know, just the list goes on, right? Of all the things we got going on. You got bills, you got to, you know, it's just, and on top of that, you got to go perform. And on top of that, you have all the trauma you're burying behind in your past, and it just adds up. And someone doesn't perform right on the field, and they automatically discount them without really thinking about all these different factors that might be going into that. So I think from an athletics perspective, I think it's important that athletes do talk to someone. You know, you're going to be a better player for this. You're going to be a better teammate. You're going to be a better brother, husband, father, whatever it may be for it. Letting it out and finding the different outlets that you're not used to or you're not comfortable with, you know, it's just self-improvement and self-acceptance more than anything.
You didn't have a relationship with your father growing up. How did you navigate the fact that you didn't have a relationship with the black side of your family? What did figuring out your Black identity, belonging, look like for you?
Yeah. I mean, that's a crazy story too. Another thing I didn't make the film. So my mom told me my dad was Jamaican my whole life, right? So again, just really seeking out, you know, the Black culture, you know, just trying to, I can't relate to anyone on my mom's side of family really, from the skin color to the way they are, you know. I love my aunties, but we're very much very different, right? But yeah, so my mom told me my dad was Jamaican. So I was like, yeah, like I'm Jamaican. I had the Jamaican flag in my room, and come to find out, when I met my dad when I was 27 years old, after having a Jamaican flag in my room in high school, he's from Barbados.
Telling you
the embarrassment, and like, okay, well, I mean, it is Caribbean, I guess, but completely different, right? So, but yeah, I mean,
we'll take you though. Yeah, we'll take you on Team JA. You're with us.
Yeah, no doubt. But I mean, it's for me, it was just a funny story. But yeah, like I always wanted to, you know, even like, I remember I tried to get my mom to, you know, I'm like, hey mom, I want to get a fade. So I showed her this picture, and she took me to like single cuts, and like I got this like bowl cut, you know, little things like that, you know, or like even how to shave properly. And like, I had, remember the first time that I shaved, I had like razor bumps, and you know, all these little things that you don't get unless you have, you know, a Black father or a Black role model to kind of show you. As being, you know, mixed or you know, whatever your race is. But yeah, it was definitely a struggle for me. And even too, it's like, even in that realm of like, you know, I play lots of hockey, so I was always like the outcast, you know, didn't have the nicest equipment, different color, skated different, you know, and you know, it just didn't quite fit in, you know, and then kind of coming back to Winnipeg and playing football, there was more culture, and I kind of fit in, but just with the wrong crowd, and not having, you know, that father figure to kind of be there to guide you, or, you know, to show you the right way, or anything. But yeah, once I did meet my father, you know, it's, we are very, very similar in a lot of ways, just mannerisms and stuff like that. But just someone that I wouldn't want to emulate or, you know, model at all, you know, as far as a father figure. He's a great guy to go have drinks with and have fun with. But, you know, when it comes actually down to being responsible and taking care of your kids, or giving some honest, real advice or hard truths, you know, I definitely could never rely on him. And you know, I say in the documentary of just like, I'm so happy that I didn't have him growing up, because I'd probably be even more screwed up.
So much of our story as Black people is breaking cycles of trauma. Now you find yourself as a Black father and a Black role model. I wonder what that looks like for you, knowing the importance of both.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the big thing for me is, I'm not an educated, you know, psychologist, or I'm not telling you, you know, I understand how philosophy and Black culture and you know, all the pain of, you know, the past for as a Black man. I'm not gonna sit here and tell you that. But I think again, there's definitely a lot of relatable stories to mine. And kids in similar situations, whether they're hockey player, football player, soccer player, you know, maybe they play an instrument, and they're just feeling that they don't feel accepted based off of their situation. And I think that's the most powerful part of it, is just being relatable in many different walks of life. And just again, highlighting the fact that here is where I was at, you might be in a similar situation, and here's where you can get to. And it's not always going to look the same. It's going to look different for everyone, you know. But it's just giving someone some hope. Some hope and honesty about how it was. Because it might get worse for them, you know. And hopefully not. But, you know, again, with the right help and resources and just being forthcoming can go a long way.
You've given hope in a different way. As a fellow Canadian Black running back, coming up, the vision was, if you play in the league, you'll play specials.
Yeah.
You'll, you know, be a support player. And even though there's been great ones before, shout out to Dwayne Ford, shout out to John Cornish. It was a fullback, someone who had to start out specials. You're the first person who, you came in as a Canadian running back, and you were a feature running back from the jump.
Yeah.
I grew up hoping to be Pinball Clemens. Now kids are growing up hoping to be Andrew Harris. They're asking for the 33 jersey. Mm. How does that sit with you in the sense that you've paved the way for all these Canadian kids to dream of being another Canadian?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, when I first went to BC, I had number 74. They put me at Y behind Jason Claremont. You know, they put me at receiver. I came back the next year. They put me at Y again at receiver. And then a couple injuries happened, and then I got to play in the super scrimmage at running back. So I always knew, like, I'm gonna learn the running back position, but learn this receiver, inside receiver position, which is basically like a tight end at that point, because the way Claremont was, his body type. So I mean, I remember I had to cut our crack block out of a bunch formation. We ran a pitch, and I had to crack Cam Wake, and I was like 185 pounds. Like, I was 19 years old at that time. I was like, this man is gonna eat me alive right now. Like, I'm dead. But I caught him off guard, and I got him, and like the whole team goes crazy. And I'm like, man, wow, I can't believe I did that. I didn't make eye contact with him for like 3-4 days because I was scared shitless. But yeah, just breaking into, you know, coming from junior and looking at the opportunity, I full on thought I'm only gonna be a special teams player, and I was cool with that. I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna make this team as a receiver. Then the following year they put me at safety, you know. So behind the scenes, and I was practicing with these guys and going to training camp, they were putting me in different spots because they didn't see me as a Canadian running back, because there wasn't really anyone. And John Cornish was kind of buried on, you know, third on the depth chart, and kind of getting a couple carries here and there. The last real one that to do it was like Sean Millington, who was, you know, out of BC as well too. When I got my opportunity, you know, I actually made the team as a receiver and a returner. So I did do 1 year as like just strictly returning. That was 2010. But yeah, I didn't play any other specials. Didn't get any other carries. I think I got a couple little carries here and there in 2010. And then 2011 was the breakout year. We were 1-6. You know, just having a horrible season. And they moved me to running back, the starting running back. Took out Jamal Robertson. We brought in Arlen Bruce, Spider-Man. And then we brought in a couple other guys on defense, and then we went on like a 9-0 run and won the Grey Cup that year. But and then it's funny, I joke about in the documentary, I was like, I thought I was gonna win the Grey Cup every year. I was like, this is easy, man. Like, let's go, you know. But again, it doesn't work out that way. But yeah, it was after that year, you know, or after that midseason, I never really looked back. But thinking, you know, wow, kids look up to me. You know, Danny Adeboy, you know, he's like, man, I idolized you. You know, like, you're my favorite running back when I was in grade 3. I was like, oh my gosh, but I feel so old right now. But you know, so those kind of stories and seeing, you know, seeing a young kid who I think has all the potential in the world to take every record and everything that I have, and helping him with every little piece of nugget. You know, a guy like Brady Oliveira, who I was a little bit closer with growing up, but you know, just seeing him when he was, you know, 14 years old, you know, just a man amongst boys, and then him training with me, and, you know, and him rocking the same eye black and doing the same celebrations, and you know, just the way he plays is very, very similar to me. It's very humbling, and I'm honored to influence and have that kind of influence on players that are so great in my eyes too. But just take it with grace and appreciative of the whole thing. And I never would imagine that I'd be in this spot, man. And it's just a complete blessing.
Yeah, we've got, you know, coaching trees in football, maybe quarterback tree, right? All the guys who've teamed up with Ricky Ray at some point. Like, you got a running back tree at this point. Yeah. Of people who've followed in your footsteps, specifically Canadians. If you think back, you went from dude who they gave the number 74 to. Yeah. Like, that's like a bad O-line number.
Yeah.
To a guy who the next choice you have to make is, okay, what haircut do I want on the bust? Like, Are we going with the fade? Are we going with a little bit more on top? Because it's a sure thing when you're eligible. What comes to mind in the juxtaposition of that starting place and that finishing place?
What comes to mind is just like, you know, just the hard work that, you know, I mean, like even with BC, you know, I was, you know, on the practice roster, and like, you have to put this in your mind, like 2 days for 6 months is absolutely nuts. Like, we go through 2 days for 2 weeks and like guys are dead, right? So I'd wake up at 6 a.m, go practice with the Lions from 8:30, or meetings, practice 8:30 to like 2 o'clock. Then I take the SkyTrain from Surrey down to downtown Vancouver, take a float plane over to the island, practice with my junior team from like 6 to 8:30, and then get on a 2-hour ferry at 10 o'clock, get over on the 2-hour ferry, get back to the Vancouver at 12, and then take a bus from the ferry down to Simon Fraser campus and get home at like 1 o'clock, 1:30 every day. Like, that was my like 3 or 4 day a week routine, and then I'd go play games on Saturday. So like that grind alone, I was enjoying it so much because I was practicing with professional, you know, grown men who were, you know, were guys that went to Texas, got, you know, guys who were MVPs of the league, and then, you know, playing safety, and I was picking off Casey Printers and like thinking like, man, I could play safety in this league and I could play running back, and then like going to practice my junior team, and everything was just like slow motion, and I was like, it was like I was playing on a little elementary school playground, and you know, but my game evolved so much from that. And I think like when I talk to kids now of like what they're doing to separate themselves and what are they doing to get themselves to the next level. And not to say that they should be doing that level, but you really need to put in a whole different level of grind and sacrifice to separate yourself that much, because that ultimately I was to me, in my eyes, I was there, but doing that, it separated myself physically, but also mentally, of how hard I could, or how far I could push myself and how hard I could really force myself to get into another level of sacrifice and willingness to win. You know, we won the national championship that year and you know, absolutely crushed it, and then it was like, I knew that when I came into that following season, you know, I was going to be a starter eventually, because I saw it and I could feel it. And again, parlaying that work ethic and that sacrifice throughout my career, and I was so into it for the first 5 or 6 years, and then I kind of just got into this like everyone does. You get comfortable, you get in kind of like autopilot, and you just coast along, right? And you enjoy the game. But there's moments throughout my career where I almost enjoyed it too much, where I lost sight of that. And going back to Winnipeg, you know, I found that deeper kind of grind and understanding. And that pushed myself to make my teammates better around me. Before, it was all about Andrew and how can I make myself better. And I really realized how to understand my teammates better and work with them better. And, you know, you look at our 2019 team and that team, you know, that we had, you know, that was an amazing team, like almost unbeatable, you know, across the board. You know, look, in 2021, it was a COVID year, but we didn't lose a game until the end of the season. We were resting everyone, like we were unbeatable, you know. Just to be a part of that and that influence that you had, and then to be just gone the next year, and I'm in Toronto, not as dominant on the field, but how can I parlay that even more now to being the leader? So I just look at those stages of the grind and where I was at and the sacrifice. And then when you put it all together, it's like, it's just like poetry. You know what I mean? It's beautiful growth. It's beautiful self-awareness, understanding. And when I think of like, if I'm just going to retire, I'm like, all I care, you know, most people are like, oh, what's how many Cubs you win and what's your stats? And I fully, like, that stuff's awesome, but to me, it is fully like, the relationships and the self-discovery and the man I've become and the man I've made, help make others better, in better players, better teammates, better leaders. That's honestly what I'm most proud of.
When someone goes through the search bar and finds Running Back Relentless on Apple TV or Amazon Prime, which is Flex, by the way.
Yeah.
What's the one thing after watching it do you want them to learn from your story?
I think there's nothing, there's not one thing that I want them to learn about. I think they can just, maybe understand me better. If they don't know me or don't know my story, understand themselves better. I think that's the key part of it is I think it's relatable to people in a lot of ways. And but I think, if you don't know me from the hole in the wall or the CFL or you're not even a football fan, I think, understanding that someone can be so dominant, so successful in any walk of life, but still be holding on to a lot of stuff. And if they're off one day, or if they're not performing the same way, or, they're in a dark place, don't just count them out. Reach out to them. I think there's a lot of power behind that. Just understanding people better as a whole. And, it doesn't matter what it seems from the outside looking in. There's always more to every person inside. And sometimes that's a dark place that they need to kind of shell out and get rid of. And but someone just understanding that and seeing that can really make a big difference.
Well, for someone who's watched your story and now had seen it, from the other side, thank you so much for how hard you rep, whether it's the running back fraternity or Canadians or black men or now fathers.
Yeah.
The representation you provide is really badly needed and important, so thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Real great story, real great lesson that even if you don't see it, if you believe it, you can achieve it. If you want to see the film, there's a couple ways. I mean, it's on these small little streaming services, Apple TV, Amazon Prime Video, Google Play. So go ahead and find it there. If you want more information, the site is www.33film.ca. And if you are so inspired to donate to the foundation and the Manitoba-based charity that helps Canadian youth that Andrew and the film is partnered with, samsfoundation.ca is the website where you can support. And it's a film that, honestly, I would implore you to play to big brothers and big sisters, to school kids, whether they're in elementary, high school, university. If you want more info on the film and screenings of it, admin@uppercanadafilms.ca is where you go. And again, I think the story for me about Andrew and his story is that, unlike me, he had the irrational confidence to believe he could do something even though he didn't see it before. And that is, if I draw a through line from his story to something I covered recently, that is the mindset of many young hockey players right now who are coming through from different backgrounds. Someone like Liev Buehm, whose parents are, Israeli born, and he's drafted in the lottery in the NHL draft. When you look at this draft, whether it's Tiija Ginla or Caden Lindstrom or Zane Parekh, you got three BIPOC kids from different parts of Canada, different communities, different upbringings, but all with a hope of being an NHL player. And despite various types of barriers of entry, all three went, not in the draft, went in the top 10. Kevin He, the first Chinese-born player to go as high as he did as a mid-round pick. I was out in Vegas at the iconic Sphere, seeing the new face of the National Hockey League. And as I leave you on this episode, here's a essay from me on this 2024 draft class, how it will be remembered, and why its impact is significant.
I'm The 2024 NHL draft will go down as the most diverse ever.
The draft, the unofficial start of a new league year, turning the page from one season to the next.
Alexander Barkov, you have the honor of hoisting the Stanley Cup.
As soon as the Stanley Cup is handed out, the execs get busy trying to build a championship organization. Some picks were more surprising than others. Beast mode came through, even the one and only Celine Dion was in the building.
Let's get ready to rumble!
And I mean, there's a sphere. Inside and out, the first live event of its kind to be showcased here. But this draft class showcases the changing composition of the sports players. Global game with global interest casting a wide net for the best.
Kevin He, left winger out of the OHL, is actually born in China. He becomes the second player ever born in China to make the NHL draft.
Eric Emery.
So many people over the years came up to me, and people of color and hockey players that told me that my dad was their favorite player and that he inspired them to play. So if I was able to do that for other kids one day, that would be super special.
For 2024 draft, Utah selects Tej
Aginla. The world's fastest sport has been slow to change, but the setting of Las Vegas was instructive, as the Strip has become the place the entire world comes to play. And that's the goal for those that lead the National Hockey League. This draft was a data point that not only is the pipeline of talent strong, it's starting to get wider.
From the Medicine Hat Tigers, Caden Lindstrom.
To be a role model in the game is what I want to do. Just people of color and people without color, just to let them know that you're not the only one, you know? Kind of tell them that you could really be anything you want to be as long as you work hard for it.
It's difficult to see young players go through adversity. This young man grew up without a father, three sisters. Hey, mom, sisters, I'm going to take care of you. This is the first step in doing that.
You're seeing the fruits of the labor, of the camps and clinics, of the ball hockey investment, of the community involvement, of those who have made it coming back to mentor those trying to make it. This year, four prospects with backgrounds diverse to hockey traditionally were picked in the top 12. It's not just a personal victory, it's a family victory. The whole village celebrates tonight.
Box office, that's what I'm going to call him, because I would pay for a ticket to see this guy play. He is that exciting.
Ultimately, all those kids who put on that oversized Fanatics jersey were just kids living out their dream. They were no different, but kids of all different backgrounds now know that playing in the best league in the world isn't just a dream. It's an attainable goal.
You love to see it.